This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I'm standing in front of a glass cabinet full of dead animals. They are taxonomic specimens. Tiny bird skins stuffed with cotton wool lying on their backs. Entomology specimens classically pinned out. They are, however, ordered in this cabinet by design and not science. This is art, not natural history. It's called Stilled Lives. The artist Janet Lawrence was commissioned to create this work for the opening of the new turn of the millennium Melbourne Museum. The museum includes galleries of history, Aboriginal and settler, and a huge gallery of life, a gallery of living trees with real birds flying around in the canopy. In a museum with multiple galleries, each with different designers and different curatorial expertise, an artist was offered the challenge of explaining to the public what the museum was about. The artist had to create a conversation piece in the space between very differently purposed galleries that said something about the museum as a whole. The installation was a feature of what the architects called the upper level circulation spine. It was the device that enabled the architects to skillfully negotiate the complexities of the contemporary museum, according to Paul Walker in Architecture Review 2001. I'm speaking also here about the museum historically at the moment in 2001 when the galleries were different from what they are now. I should add that. What does a cabinet of dead animals mean? How can it negotiate the complexities of a contemporary museum? The fact that the animals are, in Lawrence's words, dislocated from their histories, stilled in time, this is from the caption, and what's up there is from the caption too. Paradoxically, this makes the animals live. Implicit in the artist's thinking is the notion that the museum principals are dead rather than the animals, and that empathy is perhaps beyond history. Collections are, of course, the heart of the museum. As we acknowledge today with this, the third annual symposium on this subject at the National Museum of Australia. And while I'm really interested in this artwork, I want to argue here that there is an intriguing history emerging through the bodies of dead animals preserved by museums. In this section, I quickly trace the trajectory of dead animal collections in museums from the 18th century to the 21st. Initially, dead animals were collected and sent to museums to identify and name. Museums were libraries of living organisms. The Dewey cataloguing system they used was Linnaeus's system of binomial nomenclature. The animal's name gave its place in the order of nature. By international agreement, Linnaeus's names were the ones used by museums throughout the Western world from 1753 for plants and from 1758 for animals. This order of nature preceded British settlement of either Australia or New Zealand. But Linnaeus's ideas were influential in British scientific thinking and aroused curiosity in new nature. Australia was conceived of as a place of exceptional nature, antipodean, where all things were queer and opposite, that is, threatening the order of nature as arranged by Linnaeus. Thus, museum cabinets developed two purposes: scientific relevance and displays of wonder. Cabinets were sometimes ordered by the biogeography of place. Alexander von Humboldt's ideas about parallel climates were influential both to exploration and to museums. So cabinets were sometimes ordered by place. Thus, desert-adapted animals or polar-adapted animals shared cabinets rather than ungulates or felines. Taxidermists emptied dead animal bodies of the parts that would rot and refilled them so they could, in a sense, live forever, wired and stuffed in ways that recaptured the lifelike behaviour and attitudes of the animals. This was fine art and went beyond public museums. Private collectors developed a taste for taxidermic specimens in their sitting rooms, sometimes in private cabinets of curiosity, and most commonly of all as a head on the wall, celebrating a hunting achievement. You can sit in a chic cafe in Copenhagen where your waiter is a polar bear, ironically dressed in a dinner suit. A deer with elegant leather gloves supervises the same cafe's website. Already in the 19th century, the art in taxidermy was celebrated. But the mounted head on the wall glorified the hunter, not the hunted. The bigger and wilder the head, the greater the hunter. Thank you, Jenny, for those wonderful images of London museums too. That was great. Similarly, in the public museums of the 19th and early 20th century, cabinets of natural history worked to glorify empires and their resources. The more wonderful the nature, the more resources for the empire. Thus, cabinets became a signature item in imperial museums. In the 20th century, as scientific interest moved away from mere classification of dead specimens to understanding living behaviour, museums organised their cabinets differently. As the science of ecology grew, museums developed dioramas, a picturesque way to display relations between animals and their environments. Real animals, stuffed to live again, were placed on a stage with images of scientifically classified habitat. The cabinet had become a theatre. The American Natural History Museum in New York boasted particular mastery of the diorama, the art piece with a scientific message. These are now heritage items and still a point of pride. This is from their current website. The illusion of the artwork is crucial, but so is the artistry of the lifelike taxidermy animals, crouched, ready to pounce, that transform the paintings in the backdrop into informational art and real entertainment. In 1999, the National Museum of Australia purchased the thylacine skin for the Land and People exhibition. It was a key object for a module about the idea of extinction, later entitled Endling. Acquiring this object was somewhat controversial. Was extinction a suitable subject for a social history museum? And could an animal skin be part of a national historical collection? It was evident that the extinction of the thylacine was a cultural and not a natural event, and very much part of the history of European settlement in Tasmania. But the skin itself needed history. Eventually, the acquisition was approved by shifting the emphasis away from the animal to the hunter. Today, the skin is being rested for conservation purposes, but you can still find in the corner of the Endling cabinet the story of Charles Selby Wilson, the man who shot the last wild thylacine in 1930. It was this story that was needed to justify purchasing a skin that's no longer on show. This is a strangely old-fashioned story in a museum built in an era where hunting trophies are more often subjected to gender readings of their iconography or turned into retro cafe furniture than celebrated. The trope of the last wild animal was clearly important to the purchase. The skin was shot at a time and in a place where it was arguably one of the last. But the real rub was that a thylacine skin was just a dead animal, not a cultural object suitable for a national historical collection. It was not something people used, like the buggy rug comprising 8 thylacine skins stitched together, recently purchased in Tasmania. The National Historical Collection had a possum, rabbit, and even platypus skin cloaks and rugs. It had a water-carrying container made out of the body of a kangaroo. But a skin without a definite social purpose had to be constructed as a hunting trophy. It was otherwise dangerously close to being about the animal and not social history. At the Fram Museum in Oslo last year, I was privileged to see a photography exhibition that directly challenged the trope of the heroic hunter and his trophy. It focused on the polar bear, now a signature animal of global climate change. In Nanoq, the great white bear, Brudis Nebensdiota and Mark Wilson re-photographed 33 taxidermic polar bears from public and private collections in Britain. Each photograph is captioned with a carefully researched biography of the bear, its place of capture or shooting, the name of the person responsible, the nature or purpose of the expedition, the bear's history in captivity, its age at death. This exhibition is a cultural and not a natural history of polar bears. It does not celebrate the hunter, the collector, the taxidermist, or the collection house, but the bear itself. Snebjørnsdottir and Wilson's travelling exhibition has moved through a series of museums between 2006 and 2009. It's showing now as Nanoq, Flat Out and Bluesome, which is also the title of the book that accompanies the show. The book includes reflective essays by academics Steve Baker and Gary Marvin with titles such as What Can Dead Bodies Do? And Perpetuating Polar Bears, The Cultural Life of Dead Animals. Nanoq is at the leading edge of a new art movement that challenges the place of animals and their bodies in museums. The bears are no longer objects, performing lifelike animal activities in dusty dioramas, but rather particular bears from particular places at the time of their death, and in other particular places at the time of their photograph. Some bears were photographed wrapped in plastic in back rooms, deep in storage, poignant reminders of how an institution's politics can change and marginalise collections. Dead animal collections continue to function at the junction between science and art in the 21st century as taxidermic specimens and skins are used to explore environmental ethics and concerns about human rights. Animal rights. Oh, that's an interesting slip. Dead animal collections are moving out of natural history museums and into social history and radical art. Consider Mark Dion's work, 1996, Tar and Feathers. Dion, born in 1961, is a New York installation artist. His work can be found online. That's where I got this. He's also interested in what animals can reveal about humanity. With some of my work, he writes, you can sense that it has a pretty dark tone. My sensibility tends to the dystopian, to the dark side. I want to compare this art installation with this. It's a mausoleum, not a museum. It's a tree hung with dead feral cats at William Creek on the Oodna Data Track in desert South Australia. It's dubbed Pussy Willow, or Acacia felinata. In Dion's terms, such an Australian vernacular landscape has a pretty dark tone. What sort of society is mirrored in our backyard? This tree turns us away from art and back to science. It's the science of conservation biology that often provides the rational and moral attitude towards biologically invasive animals. Daryl Lewis, who works with us at the Centre for Historical Research, took this photograph of the cat tree at William Creek in 2004. His dog Kelly plays in the foreground, a touch of humour in a grim scene. Lewis found another such tree later the same year, the dingo tree of Lake Ucombe. Here there is a different ethic at play. If the desert tree is Acacia felinata, perhaps we should call this one Eucalyptus caninatus. This tree is about an economy red in tooth and claw. Someone has hung, drawn and quartered the obstacles to sheep farming in this district. These are animals that feed on other animals. They live and die in relation to animals as well as humans. The carcasses throw up questions of what it means to be feral in the Australian landscape in an era of invasive species biology. What does it mean for Australia to lead the world in mammalian extinctions? Does a consciousness of damage justify killing the perceived perpetrators? And when they are dead, should they also be strung up, skinned? Are they a warning to other wild cats and dogs, as the hanged criminal once was considered a warning to criminal elements in Victorian societies? Or are they symbolic of a new heroics of hunting, something acceptable in a world where taking polar bears is no longer so? Like the artist who holds up a mirror to the present and to the kinds of problems that we have right now, the creators of trees like this, dystopian landscape features, challenge our views of right and wrong, of humane and ecological. These trees are working like a good museum exhibit. They ask questions, they give us pause, and they do not shy away from controversy. And they are historical. They speak to the human history of this moment. Thank you.
Time for a quick question, if someone's got one.
Really interesting. Lynn Beasley from the National Museum. Just a very quick question. Has any research been done on visitor reaction to the art installation using dead animals?
Yes, actually, thank you, Lynn. That's the piece that I chucked out at the beginning. I'll go back to the... There were two reactions... This one was published in Mianjin by Tom Griffiths, and he talked to the staff who were staffing the Gallery of Life, that's the natural history exhibit, and they said visitors hated this. They were curious and they were not satisfied, because what was actually in the cabinet with the little birds was also a whole lot of words, but they weren't the words of a natural history caption. They were verbs of what had happened to the animals. I can give you an example of five. Maybe I can't find it. They were fetishised, possessed, collected, those sort of words. Anyway, they were engraved on the glass with the exhibition, and people wanted to know what the birds were, but they didn't want to know what had happened to them. That was one reaction. The art critic, Paul Walker, who was interested in the building and who came to the exhibit without having gone through the Natural History Gallery, he said visitors were enjoying Janet Lawrence's exhibit of decontextualised and ordered animals. Now, I think the order of decontextualisation has to be seen with relation to the building. That's the only way I understand that statement. But that's... So he had one reaction. The staff who were at the Gallery of Life had another. Both of those papers are published, one in Meanjin in 2001 and one in online. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Libby, for that stimulating paper.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.